Star Walker Studios presents Star Citizens United, a podcast dedicated to making the most of the future hit PC video game, Star Citizen. Greetings, citizen, and welcome to the Star Citizens United podcast. I'm your host, Lex Starwalker. Today, I'll discuss the Odin, Pyro, and Corel star systems. Hello, citizen. Welcome to episode 22. Thank you so much for flying with me today. So I'm continuing my ongoing series of lore-focused episodes, really digging into the lore of the game, all that we have available to us. And so now in season two, I've been going through the Galactic Guides on the Robert Space Industries website. So I will have links to all of the Galactic Guides I'm discussing in the show notes at starwalkerstudios.com. So you can head on over there and follow the link and follow along in the guide if you'd like. So today I'm going to talk about some star systems in Star Citizen. So the way I've kind of started organizing these episodes, you've probably already figured this out, is on one particular episode, I'll do star systems. And then on another episode, I'll do companies and ship manufacturers and stuff like that. So I'm curious how people like the different episodes. Do you have a preference between the star systems episodes and the company episodes? Personally, I really like the star system episodes. I really get into the star systems. The company stuff, although it's interesting, it's not as fun to me. So I don't know, maybe I should mix them up. What do you think, listener? Would it be better if I mixed up star systems and companies in a single episode? Are the ones with just companies kind of dry, and would it be better if I kind of mixed them up a little bit? What do you think? So the first system I'm going to talk about today is Odin, and this is the Galactic Guide to the Odin system. First discovered in 2532, Odin, marked on the initial transit logs as Odom, was one of the first star systems reached during mankind's initial extrasolar expansion. A scant 50 millennia ago, a brief flicker in geological time, the system was home to multiple vibrant ecosystems similar to Earth or Terra. That all changed abruptly when Odin's star collapsed into a white dwarf. The immediate trauma completely enveloped the system's first planet and quickly boiled off the biospheres of the others, killing all the native life. When Earth's first explorers jumped to Odin, they found a system of icy rock worlds with uniformly foreboding exteriors. The immediate thought was that the system could become a mining hub, but its lack of jump transit points and some unique stellar features quickly made it clear that such operations were not feasible. Thus, lacking a strategic position or a terraformable world, Odin was relegated to the saddest fate for a star system, weapons testing area. By the early 27th century, the demonic crags of Odin's core worlds were quickly being flattened by experimental weaponry intended for sale to the UEE military. Odin most recently became a cause of the scientific community when a group of noted geobiologists came forward to point out that the government was allowing companies like Bering to wipe clean an otherwise well-preserved fossil record that could tell the story of the life that came to evolve in the Odin system. While a grassroots Save the Fossils movement initially gained some traction in popular culture, interest soon faded. I don't find that at all surprising. The Odin 1 asteroid field, commonly called the Belt, is possibly the most interesting area of the system. The remnants of the system's pre-catastrophe first planet, the Belt is a seemingly unending field of minerals. Ore located in the Belt runs the gamut from basic sloth to valuable heavy metals, with extremely valuable and distinctive caches of gemstones being discovered more often than one would expect. The UEE formally banned mining in the Odin system, but garrisons no forces there and generally takes a blind eye to the practice. There are, however, bigger dangers to mining operations seeking to skirt the law and take advantage of the former world's riches. The first is an electromagnetic phenomenon called arc changes. The result of the exposed planetary core's iron-rich content coming into contact with cast-off stellar remnants, arc changes are deadly to any ship unlucky enough to be caught in their embrace. So many have been destroyed over time that legitimate mining operations have given up entirely on petitioning the Senate for licenses to exploit the Odin system. Heavily shielded independent ships may fare better, but the best advice is to stay away. And if the ARC charges don't get you, the pirates just might. A warren of well-armed pirates, seemingly immune to the electromagnetic phenomenon, is believed to be based deep within the belt. This group, whose organization and formal allegiance are unknown, has been involved in dozens of hit-and-run strikes against legitimate operations within a jump or two of Odin. The sum total of their effect on the countless black market gunrunners and mining operations that attempt to wring a quick UEC out of the belt is unknown. So that's pretty interesting. Might be a fun place to try to mine in Odin's belt. Definitely dangerous. You'd want some high-grade shields, that's for sure. Odin 2 is ostensibly within the star's green band, although the planet has only what little atmosphere it has naturally gathered in the last 50,000 years. Officially a UEE military operations base, Odin 2 is home to the occasional temporary deep freeze expedition. Scientists and military forces training for transpolar combat operations pass through the world, but no one lives there permanently. Most of the surface of the planet has been curtained off for weapons testing operations, with robotic survey labs belonging to ANR, Bering, and others dotting the equatorial plains. However, the planet's moon Vili is the most famous corporate weapons testing range in the system, and possibly even the galaxy. Much of the surface of Vili is exclusively owned by Bering's shadowy Applied Technology Division, which we talked about a couple episodes ago, and a notable percent of munitions expended by man in the past decade have been launched against lifeless rock formations and artificially deposited synth peeps on Vili. Bat research laboratories are located deep beneath the surface of the moon, away from all varieties of prying eyes. Testing ranges and a variety of supporting factories, like antimatter refineries, chemical compulsion units, and the like, surround the few human-occupied locations on the moon. The one part of the moon, and indeed the star system at large, open to travelers is Raleigh Station, a snowy space base erected by the UEE to allow the government and civilian contractors to bring in supplies and to ferry out weapons projects after their test cycles. Raleigh Station is not the most welcoming place in the galaxy, but there is enough to keep a traveler busy. Standard bulk food and medical supplies are always in demand here, and pilots have reported finding occasional deals on discarded military-grade surplus. Hey, there you go, traders. The second planet in the Odin system, Odin 3, is another insignificant dead world. Although weapons testing is officially forbidden here, the surface of the planet has still been burnt to a cinder and irradiated beyond recognition. A famous photograph of the planet taken from orbit and used during the abandoned ecological campaign shows a massive glowing delta-shaped blast impact cutting directly into the surface. Military sources formally deny that a weapon capable of causing such damage to a planet's crust exists. Of course they do. Odin 4 is a gas giant and home to a UEE-sponsored hydrogen rendering station and fuel depot in geosynchronous orbit. While the station is crewed, the facilities for interacting with outsiders are wholly automated. A supplier drops off unrefined hydrogen and takes on fuel without ever encountering any of the occupants. Starship crews are actively discouraged from layovers on Odin 4, although the station has a limited number of poorly maintained rental habit cubes. Fuel prices are notoriously inexpensive for this region of the galaxy, and it is sometimes even worthwhile to make the jump to Odin to refuel a larger ship. Well, that is a good thing to know. Those of you lucky dogs out there flying large ships might want to swing by Odin 4 for a gas discount. Next up is the Pyro system. If Spider is the face of piracy in the galaxy, Pyro is unquestionably the beating heart. An otherwise desolate, lifeless star system crippled by a prolonged nova phase, Pyro is most notably the home of the shared Pyro outpost of Ruin Station. Like Spider, Pyro is a case of pirates filling and expanding upon a void left when the system was abandoned by civilized developers. Unlike Spider, however, Pyro's station has not settled into an orderly system of black market commerce equivalent to that founded for proper traders on standard worlds. Here, opposing packs constantly struggle to own the station and all of the nearby action. Any prospect of developed life in the Pyro system vanished several million years ago when the system's star began to go nova. Astrobiologists who have examined the remains of its theoretical green band planets have found little evidence that higher life forms would have been likely in the first place. Nothing but algae-like fossils have ever been discovered. The system consists of six ruined worlds circling a bright but ultimately dying star. Were it not for the fact that jump points from two inhabitable systems have been discovered linking the Pyro, the system would likely never have been settled at all. The system was ostensibly discovered in 2401 by the Roustabout, an Earth-flagged tanker ship moving through the Tyrannus system on the safe route alternative to Keller's Run. The ship's watch officer noted a gravitic anomaly 30,000 kilometers off the transport's port bow and left it at that. It was not for another 44 years that the ship's corporate owners, seeking new mining territories, dispatched an explorer to the region and formally charted Pyro and its environs. This survey simply noted the overall disarray of the planetary system, the difficulty of finding transportable resources, and the unlikelihood of terraforming anything there successfully. In addition to its development as a center of organized piracy, Pyro is also a household name in the UEE today because it served as the backdrop for one of original system's arena commander's first levels. The icy blue nova and the frozen hellscape of planets slowly moving towards their destruction seemed an ideal location for arena commander's designers to show off how interesting 3D space combat can be. So we talked about arena commander last week, and hopefully you guys are playing some Arena Commander, and this scene sounds very familiar, doesn't it? Pyro 1 is a charred black rock that is slowly discorporating into Pyro proper. There's little of interest here. The space around Pyro 1 is difficult to navigate with anything but the highest quality shields, and no significant mineral deposits have been located on the planet's surface to make ever landing here worthwhile. Pyro 2 is a coreless planet that will, in time, also fall into the star. During the system's initial discovery, Pyro 2 was a major focus. The planet held seemingly significant deposits of cadmium, titanium, and gravity-forged gemstones. A minor metal rush saw human trade ships quickly deplete these deposits. Within 5 years, for all practical purposes, the world had become an empty husk. The third planet in the system is the only one believed to have once existed in the green band, pre-nova, that is. This is where tiny algae-like fossils have been discovered. For this reason, it was the initial focus of nonprofit research efforts during Pyro's initial exploration. Making life more difficult for researchers, the nova process has rendered Pyro 3 a largely magma world. With little left to discover, the scientific community quickly grew tired of Pyro 3 and the system in general. Pyro 3 is technically listed as a potential terraforming candidate by the UEE, although taming a magma world would be extremely difficult and no interest in this project has ever developed. The combination of Pyro 4, a rocky Mercury-like protoplanet, and Pyro 5, a massive yellow and green gas giant, is one of the more striking stellar landscapes yet discovered in known space. Arguably a single entity now, Pyro 4 and 5 are the result of a massive meteor strike which altered the orbit of the former into the latter. Pyro 5 now appears to be subsuming Pyro 4 in slow motion, a visual difficult to top anywhere else in the galaxy. Pyro 5 is considered a low-quality refueling point because of the poor hydrogen mix present in the upper atmosphere. So that is really cool. I wish they had an image of this on this page. I don't see one. That's going to go on to my list of things to check out in game. I want to fly over there to Pyro 4 and 5 and take a whole shit ton of screenshots. That sounds awesome. The outermost planet in the Pyro system, Pyro 6, a subdwarf, would be unremarkable if it were not the home of Ruin Station, populated by Pyro's only permanent inhabitants. Though the station's lineage was originally unclear and is today often referred to as being secretive or conspiratorial, it is now known that it began life as a Gold Horizon terraforming base, but was abandoned when it became clear that there was no reasonable terraformation to be had in Pyro or in nearby star systems. Once the original settlers abandoned the prefab station, Pyro quickly fell into use as a meeting place for black market deal making. From there, it was only a matter of time until it followed the same path as Spider, with active pirate construction and the development of a unique subculture. However, where Spider's culture centers around honor among thieves, Pyro is more based around the men with the most guns winning. Make no mistake though, Ruin Station is the home of unrepentant pirates and no one else. It is not suitable for tourism, regular trade, or even experienced bounty hunters seeking the thrill of combat. The pirates that do crew the station are the best of the best, constantly ready to stab each other in the back for a bigger piece of the action. Xeno Threat is the current pack in control of the station, although this could change at a moment's notice. Gun combat on Ruin Station is so common that shop owners have actually installed a series of armored doors. When infighting erupts, local shops and facilities automatically seal themselves off. A highlight of Pyro's dimly lit halls is Corner 4, a sequence of former research labs converted into drug factories and no questions asked medical treatment facilities. Neutrality, the station's requisite dive bar, is the only arguably safe place on the station. Armored toughs called the Cousins keep the peace here, at least in so much as they are needed to protect the bar's staff and facilities. So there you go, a pretty rough place over in Pyro. We got some good scenery at Pyro 4 and 5. And Ruin Station sounds like a good place to check out if you've got the stones for it. Finally today, we will discuss the Corral system, which is known as the gateway to the Banu Protectorate. Corral is a standard Type G main sequence star with six largely unremarkable planets located on the border between the United Empire of Earth and the Banu Protectorate, with a key jump line connecting the two. First discovered in 2449 and initially settled shortly thereafter, Corral has become the de facto customs checkpoint between the two states. The system itself was discovered in the decade following mankind's first treaties with the Banu as part of a concentrated effort to map this inhabited region of space. The inhabitable third planet, Lo, was developed first as a casual trading post between humans and Banu, and then ultimately developed into the port of call for all interspecies shipping traffic. The culture of the Corral system is an interesting mix of human frontier and Banu bureaucracy, something that has not evolved elsewhere in the galaxy. Corellians today are an unexpected combination of efficient and laid back. Beyond that, in nearly five centuries since the system's settlement, little has changed save the scale of what passes through the jump point. The first planet of the Corral system is little more than a flare-lashed iron core. Originally a rocky world close to the system's sun, Corral 1's crust and mantle were blasted away through a series of unknown impacts. The result was the exposure of the planet's iron core, which has since cooled to a solid state. No development has taken place on Corel 1, as there are far easier to reach sources of simple iron in the known galaxy. The planet does make for an attractive picture, though, with a bizarre smooth landscape resulting from the metal having rapidly cooled into its current form when exposed to space. Where Corel 1 is now entirely a planetary core, Corel 2 lacks one altogether. A dead planet with no magnetic field, Corel 2's atmosphere has been blasted away by solar winds. The surface of the planet is, however, extremely rich in minerals, and the planet is a likely candidate for future mining expansion. It is officially UEE government territory today, although a mineral rights auction is anticipated in the near future. Corel 2, on the inner edge of the system's green band, is also technically a terraforming candidate, although not a very good one. Behold, the pulsing heartbeat of interspecies commerce. Corel 3, known only as Alo around the galaxy, is the system's inhabited world and serves as the physical handshake between the human and Banu governments. The planet itself is an interesting mix. Sparsely populated plains, lazy border towns, and massive shipping customs complexes through which pass everyone from freelance traders to corporate cargo crews. Lo is essentially the last exit before the Banu Protectorate, and it has all the qualities of both a massive transport hub and a distant frontier trucking station. The usual entertainments for long-haul transport crews are in good supply, although the sheer number of customs officials stationed here, as well as guard patrol crews, serves to mediate the more unsavory of these developments. The center of the station is New Junction, a town built up around the largest customs house on world. Lines of ships can wait for up to 12 hours on a bad day to pass through the detailed inspection screening required by both the UEE and Banu governments. Roughly 1 in 10 cargoes is given a full visual inspection, and all others are subject to an array of scans and a mountain of paperwork. New Junction is located on a natural landing area, the sprawling plains of the equatorial Kaf region. While Lo is a generally temperate world, New Junction is in one of the hotter regions year-round, something which many traders dread experiencing during their layovers. Cool drinks and air-conditioned habicube rentals sell for a premium in the area surrounding New Junction. Regular dust storms combined with the city's base of prefab buildings, plus the vast quantity of shipping containers passing through, make for something of an almost prehistoric Wild West vibe. But make no mistake, this is not the lawless frontier. A fortune in legitimate shipping passes through Lo every day, overseen by meticulous customs agents. While Lo is a prime example of man's efficient industry, Corel 4, called Castor by the natives, is an embarrassing example of his hubris. Castor orbits Corel with a 786 standard Earth day rotation, placing it just outside the star's green band habitable zone. Made up of vast tracts of frozen desert, Castor is a foreboding world with no immediately apparent reason for human development. Nevertheless, the world became a symbol of intended progress during the Messer era, another target in a dictatorial march towards new levels of science and industry. Billions of credits in terraforming later, the once frozen desert planet had become a frozen desert planet with a barely breathable atmosphere. So there's an improvement. Today, almost no one lives on Castor, and few of those could tell you why. A handful of settlements dot the globe, primarily centered around deep ice mining operations. Quantities of bad ice have been discovered far beneath the surface, and it is sometimes collected for scientific purposes. Beyond that, miners subsist on occasional caches of desert-bound silica. Though rare, the discovery of a single cache is enough to make a mining operation profitable for several years. Mining contracts are the reason why the bulk of its inhabitants have come to the planet, and very few of them choose to renew for a second year. Traders looking to make a quick credit, though, could not find a more captive audience for luxury goods. There you go, traders. I'm telling you, man. I'm going to have to go back through these episodes myself once the game launches and I start figuring out my trade routes. Oh, I shouldn't have said that. Sharing my trade secrets. Well, at least I'll have company out there, right? We'll all be flying together. Safety in numbers. Corel 5 is a standard gas giant, a massive red and brown planet frequently used as a fuel stopover by merchants heading to and from the Banu Protectorate. It's otherwise unremarkable. Corel 6 is an uninhabitable ball of rock rarely encountered by anyone passing through the system. It features an odd orbit that is well off the system's elliptical plane. With a slightly less important transit point, Corel 6 might have become a reasonable outpost for smugglers, but the quality and concentration of local patrol forces in the system have all but eliminated it as a venue for cross-border black market shipping. Well, there you go. There's the Corel system. Sounds like a pretty interesting place. And as mentioned, maybe some trading opportunities there. That's going to wrap up another episode of Star Citizens United. If you would like to reach me, you can email me at scupodcast@gmail.com. You can find me on Google Plus, just search for Lex Starwalker, and follow me on Twitter at Lex Starwalker. Please visit the website starwalkerstudios.com for the show notes for this and all the Star Citizens United episodes, and you can find my other podcasts there as well. So once again, I want to thank you so much for strapping in and flying with me on yet another episode. Until next time, I'll see you out there. This has been a Starwalker Studios production, your source for quality gaming and hobby podcasts. Please see all that Starwalker Studios has to offer at starwalkerstudios.com.